Hello, junkies. Welcome to the Nocturnal Throwback Podcast, the podcast where we repodcast the 2007 first draft version of Nocturnal. Yes, 2007, the early days of podcasting when everybody was very young and nobody knew much and nothing. We'd all just gotten off the boat from Europe and we were fumbling about in this new world of technological wonder. The technology was only 2 or 3 years old at that point, so it was really, really brand new. What's going on in my life right now? I will tell you, I'm 50% of the way through The Killer, a GFL novella. Now watch me. I'm making air quotes now. Novella. Novella. Why the air quotes? Because novellas are supposed to be around 40 to 50,000 words. The Killer is already over 100,000 words and will probably finish at about 120,000 words. That's like three novellas in one. I am co-writing this book. Let's call it a novel. It's going to be sold as a novella, but it's a novel. I'm co-writing this novel with J.C. Hutchins, another author who was on the cutting edge of fiction podcasting back in the aughts. Go find his Seventh Son series. That's the number seven, T-H, the word son, S-O-N, series. Go find the old podcast and listen to it, or just go buy the thing. It should be out on, I think it's out on Audible. You know what? I'm not sure. Find the book on Amazon, buy it, read it. It's great. There are some awesome promos in this throwback episode, promos from way back in the day that if you were listening to me back in 2007, it will bring back many, many memories. And the best part of this episode, you will hear me gush, 2007 version of me, baby podcaster version of me, gush about what it was like to see my dream of being a fancy pants, big time author about to come true. Those were glorious days in my life. Absolutely momentous stuff. Watching all the hard work, all the sacrifice, watching it all pay off. It's still to this day, I am living a dream thanks to junkies like you who take their time to listen to stuff. Junkies who go buy the stuff, you know, to keep me in Cocoa Puffs and Chocodiles. And I treasure those memories so much. I treasure those days so much. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Here we go. Nocturnal Throwback, episode number 21. Let's get at it.
Enough talk. Get your junkie ass to a bookstore, get a copy of Infected, so that you can enjoy Nocturnal Episode 21. Nocturnal is a podcast-only novel you can't buy in stores and you can't peek at the end. Written and performed by Scott Sigler. More information and more free stories available at scottsigler.com. This book contains adult language, mature situations, and lots of violence. Hello, my junkies. April 1st. Is almost here. The launch of Infected in big boy hardcover is almost here. As I record this, we are only 2 days away. When most of you listen to this, we'll only be 1 day away. So on Tuesday, April 1st, get thine Siglerism worshiping butts to a bookstore and pick up a few copies of Infected. It's going to be a good time. I have a big fat episode for you with 40 minutes of story this week. Right before we start the episode, I've got a special short invite from Seth Harwood to all you New York City junkies. And right after you hear Seth's voice, we'll get into the story so far, this time with a little international flavor.
Hey, you dirty New York City junkies. This is your boy, Seth Harwood. And if you're looking for something to do on April 1st to celebrate the release of Infected and party with all the other junkies, meet up with me in New York City at 6:30 in the evening at the Mysterious Bookshop on Warren Street in Tribeca. I'm throwing down a quick reading of Jack Wakes Up, and then all the Palms Daddies, Palms Mamas, and New York City junkies are going to get down pub crawl style for all of us rocking the podcast world. That's Sigler Fool's Day. New York City style. More information at SethHarwood.com, junkies.
Hi, I'm Kian from the View from the Quad podcast and the Starting Wow podcast, available at www.viewfromthequad.com and startingwow.com. And damn it, I want to know what's going on here. We already saw the lovely mommy devour a man, but we are promised that yet more terrors await the poor Mexican. Dmitry Vasilov is the new leader of San Francisco's Russian mob. He's been sent up from LA to deal with Frank Lanza, don of the San Francisco La Cosa Nostra, the mafia. Vasilov's days are numbered because Lanza has been using a group of hitmen from the cult known as Marie's Children. Firstborn, the leader of Marie's Children, has been tasked with finding Vasilov and taking him out of the picture. Aggie James longs for the days when he was just a homeless bum, threatened only by weather, abusive teens, and angry drug dealers. For the past few days, he's been trapped in a white dungeon and watched people dragged away by severely deformed little men. He's also seen Mommy, a hideously bloated monstrosity filled with dozens of kicking fetuses. If Aggie wants to get out alive, he is to do the bidding of Hillary, a member of the Marie's Children cult. Although he's willing to do anything to survive, Hillary has one more thing he must watch, the groom's walk. I wonder if they'll have cake.
Hillary returned, carrying a big knit purse. Like her blue dress, it was cleaner than most things in the underground complex. It smelled funny, a bit pungent, like rancid meat. Hillary sat next to Aggie, letting her legs dangle off the edge of the highway sign. She patted him on the back, as if they were old buddies, as if there were two kids sitting on a bridge on some idyllic summer afternoon.
"I made it in time," she said. "Now you will see why you must help me."
"I'll help you," Aggie said. "I'll do whatever you say. Swear to God, I don't need to see anything else. I just need to get out of here."
Hillary smiled. She was missing most of her teeth.
"You still need to see this."
Movement from the captain's cabin door. Little men wheeling out the Mexican, still strapped in his dolly. He was soaking wet from the waist down. He had a wet spot on his chest where the fetus had landed. Aggie saw more movement, this time from one of the trenches that led onto the deck. Two more dollies, wheeled by little men. Hoods covered the heads of the people strapped into those dollies, but Aggie recognized their clothes. One was the cut-up Chinese guy. The other, the wounded Oakdale mobster.
"Those two, everyone will watch them. But the groom, he has privacy. He has respect. I can watch. So can Firstborn, but he is not here. A few others, the old ones."
Aggie saw stirrings in the shadowy tunnels that led onto the balcony ledge surrounding the shallow cavern. A few blanket-covered people walked out and sat, maybe seven in all, spaced out around the wide, shallow cavern.
"The other two, everyone will watch," Hillary said. "You need to be gone by then, or you will be noticed."
Aggie's pulse spiked up. Gone by then. It might happen. He might make it out. Hillary's net purse didn't smell as bad now. The scent seemed far more tolerable, even nice in a weird way. The little men fussed with the Mexican. They rolled him to the center of the smashed deck, then rested his dolly against the broken mast. The mast's combination of burning torches and blazing, naked electric lights cast harsh, flickering shadows on his terrified face.
"What happens to him now?" Aggie asked.
Now the children come out to play."
Aggie had taught himself not to scream while watching Mommy. Of course, he'd had something to bite on, and now no rusty jail cell bars in sight. So he bit down on the fatty part of his thumb. Bit down so hard, he tasted the coppery sweetness of his own blood. The smashed deck was mostly supported by dirt beneath it, but one of the hatches that led down actually had space below. Aggie knew this because of the things that crawled out of it.
"They are so cute."
The first two out looked like dirty little kids, maybe 3 or 4 years old. They wore filthy parodies of children's clothes, second or third-hand pajamas. Faded remains of a yellow bunny pattern on the blonde boy's shirt, a red-haired girl with a flopping iron-on of Barney, barely hanging by a few stubborn threads. Even from his perch over 100 feet away, he could see that both carried something in each tiny, dirty little hand.
They both carried a knife and a fork. What came out after them didn't even look remotely human. One looked like a wrinkled yellow bat. Another looked like it had a bumpy shell, with fingers as long as its whole arm and a huge thumb that might have had an edge on it, kind of like a crab claw. Still another looked like a little albino gorilla, thick and muscular, with big bulging red eyes. A small, white, red-eyed gorilla wearing a Sesame Street t-shirt and red flannel pajama bottoms. The small creatures waited at the open hatch. Them and more that came out behind them. Some seemed human. Some were even more monstrous than the first three. But Aggie couldn't even look at the gathering group anymore. His hand screamed with pain. He bit down even harder. His own blood trickled from the left corner of his mouth. The little men undid the straps holding down the Mexican. He fell forward, and they ran to another hatch at the front of the boat. They crawled inside and pulled an iron gate shut behind them. The Mexican stood up, looked at the small monsters, then ran from them, screaming at the top of his lungs. He looked stark, raving, bug shit insane. He sprinted off the deck and into one of the trenches. The children followed like a pack of tiny wolves. Stumbling, little kid running carried them forward, pajama-clad feet zip-zipping across the dirty wood. Some fell. They stepped over each other, chasing after the Mexican. Hillary giggled an old woman's giggle, and she clapped her hands.
They are so cute!
The Mexican sprinted through the trenches. Aggie now saw the trenches for what they truly were, a maze. He banked left and right without pattern or thought, sometimes turning a corner so fast his momentum would slam him into a wall. Pieces of rock and dirt would fall where he hit, and a trail of dust would follow behind him, almost as if he were smoldering. Sometimes the Mexican was hidden by the trench walls. Sometimes Aggie could see just his head and shoulders, and sometimes he could see all of the terrified man. It just depended on the angle of a particular trench. The children chased, but no longer as a unified pack. They split up, rushing down different trenches, little feet pounding away in pursuit.
"Crabapple Bob is my favorite," Hillary said,
pointing towards the boy with the long fingers and the big sharp thumb.
"I hope he gets the groom."
She sounded gleeful, just like any old aunt or grandmother watching kids run and play. Like this was a motherfucking Easter egg hunt, and she'd stashed a chocolate bunny somewhere her favorite would look for it immediately. Aggie couldn't take his eyes off the nightmarish scene. The Mexican ran down a trench that lined straight up with Aggie's position. Aggie could see the look of panic on the man's face, the wide-eyed stare, the open mouth, the snot hanging from his nose and trailing across his cheek. And from this angle, Aggie could see the little boy with the faded bunny pattern closing in from a trench on the Mexican's left. The boy turned the corner to block the man's path, then raised his fork and knife. The Mexican screamed, but he didn't slow down. He kicked out with all the strength of a full-grown man, a working man that uses his hands and body to make a living. His foot smashed into the little boy's face, throwing his tiny body backwards and into a trench wall. Blood instantly poured from the boy's nose.
"Oh, that's too bad," Hillary said. "I like little Sasha."
The Mexican's big kick had thrown him off balance. He stumbled, then fell, hands skidding before him like little dirt skis as his knees took most of the brunt. From behind him came the bat and Crabapple Bob.
"Go, Bob, go!"
The Mexican scrambled to his feet to stand again. Blood poured from his left knee, matting his frayed cotton pajamas to his skin with a deep red cling. He moved, but wasn't running anywhere. He hopped in a mad lurch that threatened to spill him to the ground again. Aggie saw little kids closing in from trenches on the left and on the right, a mass of shapes and colors, the glint of forks and knives reflecting flickering torchlight, the evil laughing, psychotic children. The gorilla boy ran on all fours, coming from the left, passing the others, and he shot out into the trench in front of the hopping Mexican. The Mex didn't hesitate. He reared back with his right hand and threw a haymaker down as hard as he could. The fist smashed into the gorilla's face, the boy's eyelid closing over the red eye just before the knuckles hit home. The boy let out a little cry, a cry that sounded just like that of any 7-year-old who has scraped a knee or been stung by a bee. Except, this wasn't a normal little 7-year-old boy. It was a massive, stubby little monstrosity. It lashed out with a backhand right, hitting the Mexican in the stomach, doubling him over, and knocking him to his back. Crabapple Bob and the bat thing jumped on him. The rest of the little kid monsters closed in. The white gorilla sat on his ass, held his hands to his eye, and kept crying. Aggie saw the yellow bat boy rise up from the pile, held by a pair of calloused hands that shook him violently. The bat boy flopped around like a rag doll, but only for a second, before Crabapple Bob's long fingers and big thumbs reached out and snapped. The Mexican's hands came free right below the wrists. Blood gushed into the air, splashing into the bat boy's face and chest before the loose-skinned little yellow thing fell on top of the Mexican. The Mexican found a new volume level for his ever-present screams. The rest of the kids swarmed on the downed man. He vanished below a pile of twisted, tiny bodies. Forks and knives rose up and down, flashing clean at first, then trailing arcs of blood.
"Why?"
Aggie croaked from a dry throat.
"They have to learn how to hunt," Hillary said. "They have to get the taste."
Aggie saw the little red-haired girl dart out of the swarm. She held a bloody, severed hand, missing only one finger. She ran away from the pack, gnawing on the thumb, like a kid working a candy apple.
"They're eating him,"
Aggie said, managing to yell without yelling, to pack all his panic and horror into a hissing whisper. His good hand held his chewed hand, both hands now slick with his own blood. The pain wouldn't stop him from screaming that much longer. Nothing could. Down in the trenches, body parts came loose. Aggie saw a curl of intestine flip up, arc wetly, then fall on top of something that looked like a blue-furred wolf boy wearing a Hannah Montana sweatshirt. Blood spread across the trench floor, turning it into mud. The kids tore at the body, laughing, squealing in delight, playing in the blood mud like any kid in any sandbox anywhere in the world. The Mexican stopped screaming. Hillary sighed.
"They always get so dirty."
A swarm of little men, hundreds of them, ran through the trenches, closing in on the kids. They wore their brown robes, moved with their strange waddling gaits. Some of them carried hacksaws. They rushed the mass of bloody, muddy children, pulling them off, holding them up so little hands and feet kicked in protest. Aggie had a brief glimpse of the Mexican's body, now missing the left arm at the shoulder, right foot gone, clothes a bloody mess, intestine strings spread about and trampled onto the ground. The Mexican still had that wide-eyed, snot-streaked look frozen on his face, except for his right eye, which was gone. Someone had probably eaten it. The little men packed in, their backs blocking the view of the Mexican's body once again. Hacksaws went to work.
"Now what?"
Aggie said. His voice sounded icy calm, which surprised him. There was nothing, nothing left that could make him scream. Whatever had to be done, he would do it. For some reason, he realized that he hadn't visited his wife and daughter's graves in 5 years. He had to live long enough to do that. He didn't know why, but he had to. And whatever it took to make that happen, he would do it.
"Now they cut up the groom to make the stew. Except the brains. Crabapple Bob gets to feed those to the queen. Or maybe they think Vanilla Gorilla got the kill. They will put the kids back in the playpen and release the other two men. We will have much stew tonight."
The word should have shocked Aggie, made his blood run cold, but they didn't. It was all academic now.
"No, Hillary," Aggie said. "I mean, what now? Like, what do I have to do so I don't wind up as stew?"
"Oh, that what now?"
Hillary looked at him, then picked up the knit purse. She turned towards Aggie and opened it so he could look inside. Inside was a baby. Deep black skin. The skin of a child from Lower Africa, still wet with afterbirth. The baby was wrapped in a blanket marked with crudely drawn symbols. Something like a triangle with an eye on it. Another, a circle with a jagged lightning bolt running through it. Both symbols had a curve coming off of them, a half circle crossed by two perpendicular straight lines.
"You take this baby," Hillary said. "You take him out of here."
Aggie stared at the wrinkled, wet child. It was asleep. Its hands were so tiny. It reminded him of his daughter's hands, of her tiny fingers, when she'd lain on his wife's chest right after she was born. But this wasn't like his child. This was one of them. But that didn't matter. The baby was his ticket out, and he'd do whatever he had to cash it in.
"Where do I take it?"
Hillary reached into the purse and pulled out a scrap of paper. On it were written three addresses.
"You start here. Sometimes people take more than one child. Maybe these will take another. If they do not, you find someone to raise him. Whoever takes him, you give them this."
She reached below the baby and pulled out an envelope. Inside, Aggie could see a thick stack of $100 bills.
"You listen to me now. You listen carefully. I can get you out of here. I can also reach out and bring you back in whenever I want. I have people up there, in other cities too. People you would never know as one of us, because they look just like one of you. This baby needs a family. You find that family. You understand?"
Aggie nodded. He believed her. After what he'd seen, he wasn't going to fuck with this. He would fulfill the mission.
"Yes, ma'am. I understand, but why? Why doesn't he stay down here with you?"
"Because he is not one of us," she said. "He is human. Sometimes mommy makes human babies, babies that don't have our scent. When this happens, they are killed. It is not the baby's fault, you understand?"
Aggie nodded again. It didn't make sense, but she was saying she wanted the human baby to live, kind of like a person who eats beef, but not wanting to eat veal, because veal was from a baby cow. He looked into the knit bag again. It was just a child. A human child. She had said so. Tiny, harmless, helpless. Aggie could save this baby. He could protect it.
"If you do not do what I say, I will get you," Hillary said. "You will be back down there."
She pointed to the spot of blood mud. He looked. The little men had removed the body parts, but there were still scraps of clothing, skin, and intestines mashed into the wet dirt.
"I give you life," Hillary said.
"And
in return, you find this boy a family that will raise him."
Aggie picked up the bag. His bleeding thumb dripped a few spots of blood on the sleeping baby's forehead. Aggie gently reached in and wiped away blood and some of the afterbirth. The baby's little face wrinkled for a moment. His tiny hands made tiny fists. Then he fell asleep again.
"Thank you, Hillary," Aggie said, and he meant it. "Okay, what do I gotta do?"
"Follow me and be very silent. I will show you the way out."
Firstborn checked his watch.
"Call them again," he said.
"Why bother?" Tricky Dick said. "They're not answering."
"Just do it, Dick,"
Firstborn said. Tricky Dick pulled a cell phone from his trench coat pocket and dialed Sly while Firstborn waited. Tricky Dick stood there for a minute, phone to ear, then looked at Firstborn and shook his head. Tricky Dick put the phone away.
"Where the fuck are those kids? They were supposed to be here 20 minutes ago."
"I told you they weren't ready for the big time," Tricky Dick said. "Sure, they did a good job on the Yee hit and some of the others, but they're not reliable for this kind of work, see?"
Firstborn clenched and unclenched his furred hands. He stood on the roof of a four-story apartment building, draped in moldy blankets that kept him warm despite the biting chill of a foggy San Francisco evening.
"Is everyone else in place?"
Tricky Dick nodded.
"Bonehead is in the back alley by the main phone line. Spidey is with him. Says the cell phone jammer is all gold and ready to sparkle. They can kill both phones as soon as you give the A-okay. Clyde is taking another circle. Should be back any second. I figured since we were waiting for those two pissants, Sly and Pierre, Clyde could keep his peepers on the prize, see?
Firstborn nodded. He'd thought Pierre had been coming along nicely for the past few years. The kid had the size, the strength, the stealth needed to be an alpha soldier, a top hunter that could provide for the family. He was also manipulatable, not the smartest child, and that made him a candidate for the hit squad. The ones that were easy to manipulate made the best soldiers. Guys like Clyde the Glide, Bonehead, and Spidey, who are with them now. The ones that weren't so easy to manipulate, they made for better solo hunters, out gathering won't-bes when they were needed by mommy, or for training, or just for flavor. The guys you couldn't manipulate, they were mostly okay. Guys like Lockjaw, Skeeter, and Devil Dan. But then there were the guys you couldn't manipulate at all. Guys like Sly. That little fuck. He went beyond independence. He was doing his own manipulation. People were starting to listen to Sly. Fort and Servo, Skeeter, even more. All the young ones that were having dreams. And Sly was using those dreams to influence them. Sly had probably got Marco Machete killed. He had definitely fucked up Pierre's training. And now Firstborn feared Pierre might be too far gone to save. Since Pierre had started hanging out with Sly, he'd gone from a hard-working, hard-hunting kid to a total slacker, sneaking out of home, wandering the streets, and killing those will-bees, killing the gang kids. For that, Firstborn had almost killed Pierre and Sly. Almost. But Sly, somehow, had played apologetic, and Firstborn had let them off with just a beating.
"Dick,"
Firstborn said.
"Do you think I was too easy on Sly?"
Tricky Dick shrugged. "Hard to say. You've killed far better for far less."
"They're all caught up in this king bullshit,"
Firstborn said.
"Bullshit? You don't believe the young ones are having the dreams?"
Firstborn silently cursed himself. He'd had Tricky Dick as his second in command, his main ringer, for so long, he sometimes forgot the man was only just over 100 years old. Not old enough to remember the real past. The real past, where he and Mommy had invented the story of the king to keep everyone placated. Not old enough to remember the gradual, centuries-long process where the fairy tales became legends, then religion. Not old enough to remember when Mommy had forgot she'd made up the stories and started believing in the prophecy herself. Not old enough to remember the first king. And he sure as hell wasn't old enough to remember the slaughter brought on by the first king. So long ago. Sometimes, even Firstborn himself forgot that he was there when they made up the story. He was there when they told it to the young ones to keep them placated, happy to stay underground, like fucking insects, because someday the king would come and lead them all out of bondage, lead them to freedom and open hunting on the humans that were nothing but prey. Everyone else had forgot. Even Hillary. They all believed in the bullshit prophecy of the king. But sometimes, the babies had that smell. Sometimes, he knew they might be the king, as crazy as that sounded, because how could they be a king when the king was a fairy tale? Firstborn didn't know the answer to that question. And when he killed those babies, the question didn't really need an answer.
"I know the young ones are having collective dreams," he said. "I just don't think they're caused by a king."
Tricky Dick shrugged again.
"I'm kind of jealous of them, see? Guess I'm too old to see the dreams. None of the old guard are having them."
A delicate but big swooshing sound sounded across the roof. Clyde the Glide landed right between Firstborn and Tricky Dick, a soft landing that Firstborn couldn't even feel. Clyde's shiny, chocolate-brown skin practically glowed in the dim evening light. Tall, almost 7 feet tall, but skinny as can be, Clyde could have almost been a ringer, if not for the huge flaps of skin that stretched from the inside of his arms to his hips.
"We are clear," Clyde said. "No one is coming or going. Lots of activity in the house."
Firstborn checked his watch. They were now 10 minutes behind schedule. Time to get back on schedule. Time to kill the Russians.
"Dick, go get the truck and pull it right up front. Tell Bonehead and Spidey to get ready to move. I'll text Lanza that we're ready. He always wants to say a few words before we go in. The target house was right across the street, a white, single-family, single-story house with yellow trim. A rarity in San Francisco, it had a peaked roof, the kind firstborn commonly saw on TV from many other places in the United States. With three-story Victorians rising up on either side, wall to wall, the little white house looked extremely small and out of place. A bedroom window sat right under the peaked roof. That was his way in. There were no tunnels in this area of the city. Bonehead and Spidey would cut the phones and come in through the back. Tricky Dick would watch the front and run interference in case any normals showed up. And Clyde would make short glides from building to building, watching for any other avenue of escape. Firstborn wasn't supposed to be the first in. That was Pierre's job, Sly's job. But they weren't there. Someone had to go in first, because Dmitri Vasilov had to die. Dmitri Vasilov took a swig out of a pint of Hangar One vodka. He loved the stuff. It was made right in the San Francisco Bay Area. Everyone mocked him for drinking it. What would Californians know about vodka? They'd ask. They all drank the real stuff from the old country. But Dmitri didn't like the taste of those. He also didn't like the old country, for that matter. America was working out just fine for him, thank you very much, and maybe it was no coincidence he preferred the taste of American vodka. The boys were getting antsy. He couldn't blame them. They hadn't been able to cut loose since arriving in San Francisco. Three of the boys, Genady, Pavel, and Oleg, were from his L.A. crew. Good guys, experienced in the ways of American crime. The other three, Sverdlov, Arseny, and Vyacek, were straight out of Russia, came over illegally across the Mexican border. The invisible fence. What a joke. Any American who believed the government was actually trying to stop the endless flow of cheap labor and manipulatable votes was an utter fool. None of the six had family in the States. That was important. Most of the existing San Francisco Russian mob, the ones that were still alive anyway, they had wives, kids in schools, mistresses, uncles, aunts, etc. And after what Lanza did to Yi, making his wife and kid disappear, all the guys with family were worried. That's why he needed hitters with no family connections. If Lanza could fly someone to Moscow to take out Pavel's mother, for example, well, then more power to him. Dmitri had to hand it to Lanza. That man knew how to be thorough. Yi's wife and kid had vanished. That was good. That was how things needed to be done. No loose ends. Dmitri Vasilov going up against Frank Lanza. The winner would get San Francisco. The loser would see his life and his entire lineage exterminated. Old school shit. City-state shit. Where you didn't just lose a war. Your civilization was wiped off the face of the map. So these six boys, plus Igor the idiot, who was good only for driving the truck, they were his San Francisco crew. Not his whole crew, but the six guys who would join him in the messy stuff. They were itchy for something to do. Soon, he would give them action, and what fun they would all have. His cell phone rang. The ringtone played the theme from the Godfather movie. Dmitri smiled, passed the bottle of Hangar One to Genady, then answered it. This is Dmitri.
Hello, Dmitri.
Oh, hello, Mr. Lanza. I have been expecting your call.
Firstborn launched himself off the roof, across 22nd Avenue. He wasn't as graceful as Clyde, but that kid could actually glide with those skin flaps, so no one was in his league. The air rushed by Firstborn's ears, through his exposed fur on his arms and shoulders. The moldy blanket stretched out behind him like a rancid cape, exposing the Kevlar vest, steel-toed cat boots, black jeans, and the custom H&K Mark 23 pistol holster strapped to the outside of each thigh. As he arced towards the window, Firstborn pulled the silenced Mark 23s. He crossed his right forearm over his eyes. The glass would cut his body, but he would heal. He tucked his legs in tight as he hit the window, compacting his whole body into a tight ball that shattered through the glass and thin wooden frame. His work boots and heavy jeans took most of the damage, although he felt glass slice through his arms and knees and shins in some places. Firstborn landed in a glass-crunching crouch that rattled the floor. Clyde may have weighed next to nothing, but Firstborn clocked in at around 350 pounds. Two people sat up on the bed, a twirl of naked white skin and satin crimson sheets. Before the folds of sheets even reached their apex, Firstborn fired three whispering shots from each Mark 23. The sheets descended on two twitching bodies. He stood and walked to the bed, pulling the sheets back. One body, a woman, was gurgling for air, quite ineffectually thanks to the bullet that had torn out her throat. Next to her lay the man, bullet holes in his right shoulder and his heart. The right half of his jaw was gone, a bloody void of flesh and bone and red-smeared pieces of teeth. The man blinked in wide-eyed surprise, as if he didn't understand that he was already dead. It wasn't Dimitri, but that was okay. Everyone in the house had to die. Firstborn put one Mark 23 to the forehead of each human, then pulled both triggers, then turned to face the door.
I want to say, it was nice to visit with you yesterday, Dimitri. That took a lot of balls.
Thank you, Mr. Lanza. That mean a lot coming from you.
Sad today you'll be leaving us so soon, though.
I hadn't planned on going anywhere.
I hear you're taking a little vacation,
Lanza said.
And that I'll have to say my goodbyes now, because I have a feeling that the cell phone reception is about to take a crap on us.
Dimitri smiled. He waved to the six men and his crew. They nodded, then started checking their weapons.
That is funny, Mr. Lanza. I am on the Verizon Wireless. My cell phone reception is very good. I bet that we won't get disconnected at all.
Firstborn heard a man pounding towards the bedroom door. Probably a guard, posted to make sure the two humans weren't interrupted in their fucking, who came running up the stairs when he heard the glass break. Firstborn waited until the footsteps stopped and the door handle turned. He extended both arms and fired eight silenced shots, four from each Mark 23. The thin interior door sprayed splinters as eight holes suddenly appeared. He opened the door to see a body on the ground, white shirt already a sheet of blood. Firstborn put both Mark 23s to the dying man's forehead. He ejected the magazines, popped in two fresh ones, then strode down the stairs. Down on the first floor, he heard handguns firing and the screams of men and women.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can still hear you,
Lanza said. Dimitri waved, and the white DP delivery truck's back door rolled up. The six Russians hopped out, casually holding handguns against their thighs or tucking MAC-10s inside their suit coats. They walked across Columbus Street, scooting around the slow city traffic, heading towards La Roca's Corner Tavern. Two evenings in a row, spending 6 hours in the truck, waiting for Lanza to make his move. Lanza's special assassins, whoever they were at this moment probably attacking the house on 22nd Avenue. That meant Lanza would only be guarded by his usual mob cronies. No one of note, really, except maybe for the one they called Tony Fourballs. Dimitri had a feeling that one was a serious adversary. Call it superstition, but you had to watch out for any man with a sack that big. Too much testosterone could make a man unpredictable. Dimitri hopped out onto the pavement.
How about now?
He said into the cell phone. Two big guys wearing sports coats, one tan, one black, were leaning on a metal doorway gate to the left of La Roca's. They took one look at the seven Russians crossing the street, reached into their coats, and were immediately cut down by Sverdislav and Arseny firing silenced MAC-10s on full auto. Both men twitched and flinched, as if stung by a dozen bees. Then they fell to the ground, hands clutching at the fresh red flowers blossoming on their white shirts.
Can you hear me now? Dimitri said.
Lanza hung up. Dimitri jogged towards Taylor Street. It intersected Columbus at a narrow angle and led to the back of La Roca's. Vietchik followed him, four going in the front door, two at the back. Dimitri had a nice surprise for Frank Lanza, a surprise labeled AKS-74U. He'd taken off the collapsible stock, so it hid nicely beneath the left side of his plaid sports coat. Before Dimitri and Vietchik turned the corner, they watched Genady light a Molotov cocktail and throw it right through the glass door of La Roca's tavern. From the back of the bar, Frank Lanza heard breaking glass, then a woof as something caught fire. Then screams from his men. And screams from some people who just happened to be in the bar for a drink.
"Boss," Tony Forball said. "What the fuck?"
Tony instinctively put himself between Lanza and the front door. Two more men, Charlie and Vinny, stood up between Tony and the flames dancing across the floor. They already had their guns out and were looking for a target.
"Tony, get me the fuck out of here," Lanza said. "Dimitri was fucking waiting for our move. He's here."
"He's here? How can he be here? We're hitting him right now."
"Tony, stop fucking thinking and start moving. Get me out of here."
"Back door, boss," Tony said. "Don't move yet. I'll call out. They could be waiting for us."
Lanza crouched under the table, peeking towards the front past the big bodies of Charlie and Vinny. People were trying to avoid the flames that licked up from the center of the bar. Lanza heard gunfire, handguns, and maybe some silenced automatic shit. He saw people scrambling away from the flames go down in sprays of blood. Charlie and Vinny shot back. Too bad for anyone left standing in the crossfire. La Roca's tavern sang with the crackling of spreading flames, the whizzing of bullets, and the roar of gunfire.
"Boss, Sammy and Anson at the back door, but I count at least four guys out front. We gotta go, now!"
Lanza stood to run, but stopped. Dimitri had played them. The big show of an endless party at a known Russian ganghouse on 22nd Avenue. Then, as soon as Lanza made his move, Dimitri had people waiting to go after him in La Roca's. Dimitri was making chess moves here. All the guns up front were meant to drive him out the back.
"Got one!" Charlie said.
Just then, Vinny's head snapped back, and he sagged to his ass before falling to his side. Blood poured out of his head, both from the front and the back.
"Tony, stop!" Frank said. "We're going out the front!"
"Boss, that's a bad idea!"
"Tony, fucking make it happen, now!"
Tony blinked twice, then nodded.
"Charlie," Tony said, "get the fuck down!"
Tony reached into the front of his pants, fished around, and pulled out a green army grenade.
"No wonder he looks like he's got four balls,"
Lanza thought. Tony pulled the pin and tossed it into the front of the bar. Lanza pressed his hands to his ears and lowered his head. The grenade went off, shatteringly loud in the small bar. Something stung his right shoulder, something like a hot nail. The whole place rattled, and his ears screamed. A big hand grabbed his right shoulder and pulled him forward. His feet crunched on broken glass, stumbled through burning flames, stepped on fallen bodies, and slipped in wet blood. Tony Fourballs pulled him forward. More gunshots. Charlie was shooting people laying on the ground.
"Charlie, behind us!" Tony shouted.
"Got it!"
Charlie said.
Tony reached the front door, pulling Lanza through like a big clumsy kid. Behind them, Lanza heard a heavy caliber weapon open up on full automatic. Charlie screamed, then gurgled, then said nothing. Lanza felt himself being shoved into a car, felt the car door shut, heard more gunfire, heard the car start, then felt a lurch as the car screeched out onto Columbus Avenue. Dmitry Vasilov looked out the shattered glass doors and front windows of La Roca's Corner Tavern. A Chrysler 300M shot down Columbus. That Frank Lanza, he was tough and smart. It didn't take a genius to realize he was being flushed out the back door, but still, under fire, it took a strong mind to stay calm and see the right tactic. Who would have thought they'd use a grenade on their own place? Genady stood up from behind the burning bar, careful to avoid the slowly spreading flames. Within minutes, the whole place would be an inferno.
"He used grenade," Genady
said.
"Whatever the fuck! Those Italians are crazy!"
Dmitri smiled and nodded.
That is why this will be so much fun, Gennady Ivanovich. Because Frank Lanza is no pushover. We had him this time, yet he slipped away. Did anyone else live?
Gennady hopped over the blood-slick bar and scooped up Pavel.
Help me with him. He is fat like pig. The rest, they are dead. That one killed them,
Gennady said, pointing to the bloody mess of a man that Dmitri had cut down with his Kalashnikov AKS-74U rifle.
He shot those that weren't killed by grenade.
Why didn't you stop him, Gennady?
Me? I was behind bar, ducking shrapnel from fucking grenade, boss. You understand. Now, please, help me with fat boy Pavel.
Gennady scooped under Pavel's right shoulder, Dmitri under his left. Dmitri couldn't be too mad at Gennady. Pavel's right shoulder looked torn up a bit, and he was bleeding from a big cut above his right eye. But he would live. Echoing sirens announced the cops were already on the way. The three Russians headed for the back door. Igor the idiot would have pulled the truck around by now and he would be waiting for them. Dmitri would have to go to the second safe house, hole up, and try and come up with a next move. Frank Lanza was still alive. And so, too, were his special assassins. And that was not good. Not good at all. There you go, Junkies. Nocturnal, episode 21. I'm figuring there's somewhere between 5 and 15 episodes left in this bad boy. Probably closer to 15. Well, April 1st is almost here. Those of you who don't want to hear me prattle on about this grand moment in Siglerism, go ahead and turn it off because there's nothing else of actual story value in this podcast. Those of you who are hopelessly addicted to the mellifluous sound of my beautiful sonorous voice, well, you can keep listening. What can I say to you guys? We're one day away from Infected hitting all the bookshelves of all the bookstores in America and only a few months away from England, New Zealand, and Australia. And a few months after that, Germany, Belgium, Japan, it's really kind of spiraling out of control. Come Tuesday, it's the culmination of a lifelong dream, which is to get the big hardcover, get into all the bookstores, and get the full support of a publisher. And believe me, Crown is supporting this thing more than I could have ever imagined or ever have hoped for. In the past few days, I have been on NPR twice. They have run a giant ad in a New York Times book lover email list that went out to like 500,000 people. I have been reviewed in Entertainment Weekly magazine, and the review even had some original art of a University of Michigan Wolverine football player scratching at himself. It's so freaking cool. InfectedNovel.com is completely off the hook. Those of you who have seen it know that it's just awesome, know what an awesome job the guys over at Crown did on that website. They said they had over 100 requests for materials like postcards and stickers and the temporary tattoos, and they're already out of everything. But they will be getting more very soon, so if you want that stuff, go ahead and go to InfectedNovel.com, go to the download section, fill out that form, and they'll get it to you right away. It's a great combination of Crown believing in their author, stepping up to the plate, and providing material because the author says that people are going to come and get it, and at the same time, Crown not being prepared for the demand that the junkies would put on them. And how could they be prepared? Publishers just are not used to this. I'll have links to all those interviews and all that stuff in the show notes for episode 21. I might be dropping them in all by themselves. But I want you guys to remember something. That April 1st, that Tuesday, April 1st, as you bask in the warmth of bookstores everywhere, it's not just about me, because it is about me and my giant swollen ego. It's not just about me. It's about all of you original junkies who've been listening for years. All you original junkies who went out and bought Ancestor. All you original junkies who listen in every week and make sure that my download numbers are high enough to get attention of different people in the media, get attention of the publishers, etc. Everything that happens from April 1st on is directly attributable to all of you. I want to say thank you. I'm actually going to be nice for once in my life, and I'm going to say thank you, original junkies. You all kick ass. Now, never again will you hear me be nice, because General Siglerissimo must instill discipline in the troops. And you can't instill discipline in the troops if you be nice to them all the time. I know you guys understand what I'm saying. So when you go into that bookstore, I want you guys to feel the excitement. I want you guys to revel in the knowledge that all of you have helped make someone's dream come true. Granted, I have been busting my ass for the past 3 years. I haven't had any weekends, barely taken any days off,
Traveled to all these conventions, burned up all my vacation days, and boo-hoo, scattered grazed the river. I put in a lot of work, but all that work would have been for nothing if it wasn't for the original junkies. I'm not going to forget it. That's why we have the original junkie badge on the website over at scottsegler.com. So when you guys go into that bookstore, soak it up. Soak it up. Enjoy it. Bask in the moment. You all made this happen. It's a celebration of you, just like it's a celebration of me. In fact, maybe it's a celebration of all of us together. It's kind of a happy, happy, joy, joy thing. You know what? Throw in some Care Bears and some Skittles, and we can have us a happy-go-lucky party. Woo! Well, all right, screw that. I gotta go kill something. But anyways, you guys, hook yourselves up April 1st. Get yourself some copies. I don't know where we're going to wind up on the New York Times charts. If we'll make the New York Times charts, if we'll hit number one, it could definitely run the gamut. I hope we do make it on there, and all you guys can celebrate that with me as well. Another episode of Infected coming up next week. I'm hoping to be consistent with the nocturnal episodes, but the book tour is coming up, and that's going to be a little bit wacky. So I'll catch all you guys soon. I will be dropping news in the feed on April 1st sometime, let you know what's going on, and I'll be reporting all the numbers as they come in. Catch you later, junkies.
You have been listening to Nocturnal, written and performed by Scott Sigler. For more information, go to scottsigler.com. All music in this podcast provided by Uncrowned off their album Devils and Angels, available now at the iTunes Music Store. Is it?